The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
President Trump just making that announcement in the Oval Office, where he is meeting with the CEO of Gilead, and just told the reporting pool that he has approved the use of remdesivir for emergency use. A release that is just out from the Food and Drug Administration says that remdesivir will receive this emergency use authorization for the duration of the COVID-19 pandemic, however long that lasts. Of course, earlier this week, we learned that remdesivir accelerated recovery of patients who were taking it during a trial run by the National Institutes of Health. Certainly, that was a positive development. This is an even more positive development to allow this drug to be used in emergency situations and getting that FDA approval for this specific use case.
A potential glimmer of hope out of the U.S. Walk us through the latest data on infections.
Good morning, Yair. Yeah, a potential in the sense of what we're seeing in this data looks like a flattening of the curve when you look at the country's average. So the country's average of cases has grown by 1.2% from the day before. That's down from what we saw last week, an average of 3%. But, Anera, there's always a but. When you look at some of these states, things actually seem to be getting worse in some of increases. New Jersey, the neighbor of New York, which is, of course, the epicenter, reported 460 new deaths, a record one-day increase, according to Governor Phil Murphy. Texas also saw its highest death toll. And then on the West Coast in California, they're seeing a pickup of cases. Cases rose more than 5%, biggest one-day jump of new infections. So on the average, things seem to be getting better, but there are certain spots in the country where actually things are getting worse.
First quarter GDP down by 4.8%, much worse than estimated. No surprise there, particularly when you have a non-residential business spending really going to be hurt by the likes of oil and gas that already started to shut down. No doubt all of that going to get worse in the second quarter. Personal consumption off by 7.6%, whopping down 7.6%, almost double of what we had estimated going into this. And inflation pretty much steady as she goes. A core PCE quarter on quarter is just 1.8%, slightly higher, but we're still around that 2%. So inflation clearly nothing to worry about at this point.
I think there are a few things you can say about the path ahead. First, this time now is going to be a time of sharp contraction in economic activity, high unemployment, personal consumption expenditures have declined sharply, business investment as well, unemployment moved up. We're going to see economic data for the second quarter that's worse than any data we've seen for the economy. And they're a direct consequence of the disease and the measures that we're taking to protect ourselves from it.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The economy contracts by 4.8% in Q1. The unemployment claims jump to over 30 million this week. The House passes another $500 billion stimulus bill. And the FDA authorizes remdesivir for COVID-19 as tech stocks pulled the indexes down this week, with all three major indexes down about 0.5%. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me will be Robin Griffith. He thinks this is nothing more than a bear market rally. In fact, he doesn't see a new bull market until 2023. He also sees the breakup of the petrodollar. Also on the program, Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus will join us. Dan says, at oil between $15 to $20 a barrel, no one makes money. And if it's to remain there, even much of OPEC could go under. Later on in the program, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But before that, let's find out what drove the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. And the main catalysts this week were earnings, valuation concerns, and a news article in the Washington Post, which basically suggests the U.S. might penalize China for its handling of the coronavirus pandemic. From the March low to the April high, you know, the S&P 500 is up nearly 35%. And in the face of an economy with rising unemployment and falling sales, that seems overly optimistic of a V-like recovery for the economy as the U.S. begins to relax its shut-in policies on business. So we've been getting this rally up until now. Let's call that the reopen trade rally. And you know, not every state is going to be reopening at the same time that Trump has allowed for states to make that decision, which was basically May 1st, today, on Friday. So California alone announced a similar phases plan, like Trump's plan, with certain businesses able to open, but at this point gave very vague guidelines on who that is and how these new guidelines will be enforced. And there was a lot of detail, but still too many unknowns. I believe that New York has specified May 15th. So we still have several states that aren't deciding to actually even begin reopening until May 1st. Beaches were reopened about, I think, a week ago in California and have been closed again. So things are still essentially evolving through all of this. And, you know, the idea that we're going to have a V-like economic recovery, I think, is far-fetched. However, there's many consensus estimates in the economic circles that the third quarter could possibly see very large two-digit growth in GDP, just as we possibly may be seeing double-digit decline in GDP here in the second quarter. But let's get down to the facts this week. There was some volatility again in oil as the June contract fell down 24.5% on Monday before rising 53% through the rest of the week from the last I checked at $19.57 per barrel. With energy stocks holding up well in the face of oil falling in the early part of the week, it was viewed as very constructive for many pro-cyclical areas, which we saw outperform in the first portion of the week. Those areas were pro-cyclical like energy, industrials, technology, information technology, financials, as well as in small cap stocks versus large cap stocks, which have been leading all throughout the month, in addition to a lot of the non-cyclical defensive areas. Healthcare, I believe, is one of the best performing sectors for the month of April. Now, there were some positive responses to earnings during the first portion of the week. That was for Alphabet, Boeing, and MasterCard, up each, I think, more than 5% on the day on their earnings announcements. And on the flip side, there were some negative responses to many of those names that had already performed well in April. So Merck, Pfizer, and there was actually a downgrade for Johnson & Johnson after, you know, like I said, healthcare just stood head and shoulders above most of the other sectors in April on vaccine hopes, as well as just being non-cyclical in nature. But the reopening trade, which favored cyclicals and discretionary sectors in the first portion of the week, saw some profit taking in the later part of the week because Thursday, the Washington Post reported the U.S. is looking into measures to penalize China for handling its pandemic poorly and communicating with the rest of the world. So this has become the excuse the market has needed to begin taking profits. So the profit taking began in what has largely been overdue at this point, since I believe that most of the market has responded very positively towards the idea of reopening on May 1st. So buy the rumor, sell the news is what I think we're setting into here. And if we get into more politics over the virus with China, it could really result in possibly resurfacing trade issues, like we've seen in the past, that can affect supply channels as well as manufacturers. So that's one of the concerns that's hitting the market late in the week. But let's turn to Friday. Now, with Amazon down high single digits, they announced an operating profit of $4 billion it thinks it will see in the second quarter. But due to the COVID-19 coronavirus and its related expenses, they believe that the profit they have will largely be spent. Elon Musk made a big tweet on the price of Tesla stock being too high, causing a double-digit correction there. And so some of these high-flying names, high-growth names, very widely cap-weighted names, Apple, etc., really affected the market on Friday. That spilled into, I think, a lot of high-priced growth stocks. Western Digital was down double digits as it suspended its dividend, and there were many other chip stocks participating in the correction on Friday. As we head into May, I think economic indicators are going to be playing a much greater role in the market recovery or continuation of what started a bear market. And it's our belief at Financial Sense that we'll be going through a consolidation phase now as stocks wait for the economics and earnings to play catch up to largely a Fed-stimulated and government-stimulated fiscal accommodation that has led to this rally and the hope that by reopening businesses that we'll be able to recover rather quickly. But I think the profit-taking portion needs to happen here first. FactSet did a great job on Friday with an article from Sarah Potter about the five economic charts to watch in the weeks and months ahead, starting with GDP. So let's talk about that real briefly here. A consensus is that we'll enter a recession in the second quarter with a consecutive drop in GDP. The first quarter shows a 4.8% contraction GDP, and you need two negative quarters to technically call it a recession. There is some belief that we'll be in possibly a depression here, which is signified by a decline in GDP of at least 10% or a prolonged recession that lasts more than 3 years. I don't think we're looking at a prolonged recession here unless there's no vaccine and we stay shut in. But obviously, I think governments, states are moving towards open businesses. But the idea of having a double-digit GDP drop in the second quarter, that is a very real possibility. The other four indicators that Sarah mentioned was unemployment claims, which we've been charting and talking about regularly on the program, consumer sentiment, bank loans and deposits. I haven't talked too much about that. And obviously oil prices, which we've talked about at length, contributing to a lot of market volatility. Unemployment claims have been decelerating over the past few weeks, but we hit around 30 million Americans filing for unemployment benefits over the past 6 weeks in their recent report this week. And that's just staggering and very sobering. But that's it for this week. You know, the ECB and the Federal Reserve Bank did meet this week, but I don't think it was much of a catalyst, didn't really move the market all that much. But they did continue to really specify that they will continue to have continued willingness to do whatever it takes to make sure that the U.S. economy recovers out of this and has the stability that it needs to recover, including an expansion of the Main Street lending facility, which is likely to continue to support the market from substantial sell-offs here in the weeks ahead. But that's just my opinion. Charts of M2 money supply are really accelerating. This is something that we talk about in our investment meeting weekly of just supporting this market. And that may be why gold continues to hold up above its $1,700 level and why the gold miners, we didn't talk about it, I think, so much last week, but they broke out above a 7-year base and that is holding this week. So just remember that the virus hit miners too. And I don't think, you know, we're talking about gold prices high, oil prices, their input costs low. It's a recipe for success. But global data, just reading some statistics here, from 32 countries have locked down or suspended over 1,600 mines. That's coming from global data. While the price of gold is up and oil is down, miners still need to mine to realize that win here in the commodity prices for those producers. But you know, we'll see if everyone's going back to work. Just a great situation for those gold miners. And that's why we own quite a few. And that's it for the market wrap up this week.
According to the renowned author and the nation's leading authority on generational research, Neil Howe, America entered what he calls a fourth turning in 2008 and will likely be in this period at least until 2030. This fourth turning is a period accompanied by radical change and often a series of crises. Neil Howe wrote the book, The Fourth Turning, in late 1996, making a series of predictions on what we should expect to see around the mid-2000s playing out into the 2030s, much of which has come true as they predicted over two decades ago. FS Insider spoke with him this week to talk about his generational research, what it is they uncovered, and what he thinks is likely to transpire over the next decade. Here's a clip of what he told listeners.
What we said was, is that sometime in the middle of the 00 decade, that we would have a catalyst which would plunge America into a new turning. And that would happen roughly as millennials were just beginning to come of age into adulthood. That is the first wave of millennials born in the early 1980s. Just when Xers are beginning to move into midlife and as boomers are beginning to retire. And it would probably be accompanied by a great devaluation in financial assets. And it would set forth a new mood in a new era that would last about a generation. So that was all in our original book. You can go back and reread it. And we outlined some of the kinds of catalysts and crises we might see. We had four examples in there looking at how we might react differently in a fourth turning era to these crises. And I think a couple of them we outlined were terrorist groups inflicting a huge damage on New York. This was written in 1996. And yet another one was a pandemic. So it's interesting. Four out of five of those have happened.
To listen to this full interview with Neil Howe, in addition to our three other interviews airing every week on FS Insider, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939. Or email grow@financialsense.com.
Stocks continue to march forward in this V-shaped recovery that we've seen since the bottom of the market. Will it continue, or is this just a bear market rally? Let's find out. Joining us on the program from London is Robin Griffith. And Robin, let's talk about this downturn, which was fast and furious. I think in 5 weeks, we did normally what you would see in a bear market over three in a six-month period. But since bottom, we've had this tremendous velocity return up. Does this continue, or do you see this more as a bear market rally?
Yeah, no, on my work, I'm sorry to say it's a bear market rally. The reason why the U.S. is a bit different, I mean, our market is down a couple of percent today over in England. But the reason why the U.S. is different is it is a big and powerful economy. And you are in the period running up to a presidential election. And there's so much money around of it. I was reminded of Senator Everett Dirksen, who used to say a billion here and a billion there, and you're talking real money. Well, now we're doing it in trillions, thinking of quadrillions as the next thing. So I think in this particular period, the rally in the US is better than you're going to get elsewhere. And there's something else, which I've actually put in my newsletter. It's the top five stocks, mainly in the high-tech area. So Facebook, Amazon, Nextbook, Alphabet, and Microsoft, they are up 5 to 6%. The rest of the market is nothing like that. And there's one other thing which technicians know, which normal people don't know. And if you'd ask most people, when do the biggest rises take place? They'd say, oh, in a bull market. And when do the biggest falls take place? They'd say, oh, in a bear market. But that sounds right and it's logical, but it's not what actually happens. In reality, both the biggest falls and the biggest rises take place in bear markets. The ratio is something like 18 out of the last 20, that sort of number. So the more violent and sudden you see a rally after a big fall, in my mind, immediately it's a bear market rally. And if you think about it, on the 12th of February, the US S&P was at a new all-time high in a roaring bull market. And then when it started to go a little bit weak, the traders would have said, let's sell something, something easy to sell, very liquid, we'll do a trade. And maybe they were short Amazon, Apple, and whatever. And then suddenly, to their great surprise, courtesy of a germ, they were up 30%. They have an absolutely urgent need to close that and make the profit by buying back. And of course, they know other traders in the same position. So the initial part of the rally, because it's bear closing, is incredibly violent. And then, of course, others coming in saying, well, they're the best stocks anyway. Those are the ones I want. They're full of growth. And that's why it can feed on itself. And with the money around, provided by the Fed, encouraged by the president, I think, you know, this is quite dangerous. But even on the US chart, it's still a bear market rally. And in my newsletter, I actually rank asset classes in descending order of merit. And I rank them all the way down into quintiles. And what the model does, it only lets me buy the top quintile. So they've not only got to be going up, they've got to be going up quite a bit faster than everything else. And I can tell you there are no Western world stock markets in the top quintile. Now, why we've done quite well is my own, this just following this model, got me into gold as my biggest holding before anything else melted down. So all I can say is the signs that we were toppy and going to have some sort of setback were coming along before it melted. Of course, I didn't know anything about diseases, but what a model is saying we do, bearing in mind it's British, it's saying we are actually short UK equities, we're long gold, we're long index-linked gilts, which is TIPS, I think you have in America, that sort of thing. And it's a very risk-averse portfolio, except gold, which looks terrific, basically.
Robin, one of the things that strikes me about this market was not only how fast and furious it was on the way down and then on the way up, but we've seen some things in this market we haven't seen before. We saw oil prices go negative by almost $40, and we've seen interest rates on 10-year treasuries fall below 1%. In fact, several weeks ago, treasury bills were negative.
Yes, yes. No, you're absolutely right. I think the safest asset on the planet ought to be a U.S. Treasury bond. And ever since Mr. Greenspan, Bernanke, Powell, whatever, they're not that anymore. They're now rather dangerous assets. And this has now become global as well because other central banks have copied the Fed. And then the second thing, the oil crash is also an epoch-making event. And that alone would have made me pretty bearish, even if there was no disease around at all. I mean, in the case of oil, if you said to somebody, oil, the power of the world, could go from $150 to they pay you to take it away, we would have thought they were crazy and they'd have gone to hospital, wouldn't we? But that's what we've actually seen happen. It goes back to President Nixon and Mr. Kissinger, who announced that the US dollar would not be linked to gold. It will now be linked to oil. And the quid pro quo that went to that is a US said, we will defend Saudi Arabia's oil field. That's part of the deal. And of course, back then, the US bought an awful lot of oil from Saudi Arabia. And the whole petro dollar thing built up. And because that's gone on for so long, the world is really very, very short of dollars at the moment. However, what we've now got is Saudi doesn't sell much of anything to America. Its biggest single customer is China. And you've got a whole different bunch of people trying to trade over there. And they don't want to have to go through the dollar to do these bargains. So a period, if it continues, of unwinding the petrodollar and moving into a new era. And in the new era, the authorities will try not to let any one currency dominate the thing, just as the dollars dominated it for 50 years or whatever. And before that, we had the pound. But I think if I had to name a currency, it would be China. But I think what we're going to go through is into a basket of currencies. And the OPEC currencies and even Russia will be perfectly happy to trade oil in return for a basket currency in which no one currency would be super dominant. So this would unravel eventually the petrodollar and move into a new era. And of course, this will take a long, long time. So on my basis, we're still seeing strong dollar, which is why when we originally had the stock market crash, at that time in dollars, the price of gold came down. It's now put that right and gone back up. But a lot of people couldn't understand gold falling in dollars because in every other darn currency on the planet, it was going up. But I've now just published a chart showing even in dollars, it's going up. And in a basket of 20 other currencies, it's flying up. So all of my work is saying whatever else we're moving into, it's an oil game. It's not a commodity game. It is particularly gold because gold is behaving like money again. It's not a commodity, it's money. And in this other part of the world, which is big, they're trying to move into an asset class linked to a basket of currencies with a real asset like gold in there, rather than only going through the dollar, which is what they've had to do for whatever it is, 40, 50 years.
So when we take a look at this unwinding of the petrodollar, what we're seeing in the oil markets, we're really talking about Robin Teutonic shifts that are taking place globally coming out of this.
Yes, I don't like to be a panic-stricken idiot, but I'm sorry to say that my work is telling me what we need to do is to get into our heads that this is nobody's fault. No politician produced this. Nature has produced a disease. And it's already given us a hit. What was the figure for the U.S. economy? Off 4.8%. On a forecast by the end of the year, it could be 30%. That the absolute minimum, according to the IMF, is the economic damage will, as a minimum, be twice as bad as what occurred between 2007 and 2009 when Lehman Brothers went. Now, what's happened is, of course, it's happened so quickly that most people haven't felt the punch yet. So they're walking around saying, hey, the sun looks good. I like Apple. Isn't things bullish? We're going back to a roaring bull market. In my method, the old normal is dead. It is completely dead and broken badly. And the negative interest rates, the oil crisis all add to this. And that even if the death rate from the virus flattens right out on that curve that they show us and people start going back to work and visiting things, we can't go back to watching rugby matches and going to restaurants, pubs and all of that sort of thing. Because in the countries where they've tried to do that, all they find is the death rate goes straight back up again. And then when you talk to the doctors or the scientists behind the doctors, they're saying the way out of this is generating a medicine that cures us. Now, we've got several medicines that they've got some in America, we've got some, all of which are having research done on them. And doctors are saying any one of these has got a very good chance of working. But to go through all the development and the tests to make sure it's working, it usually takes a minimum of a year. Well, if we go on for the rest of the year, like we've done for the last month, it's, you know, the damage to the, we're talking depression. We are already in a recession. And in many countries in the world, it might turn into a depression. Now, it may well be that the US and the UK managed to get away with a hit to the economy, but it's not a depression. We've got all sorts of systems and good health services. But this is global. There are plenty of countries in the world where the health system can't withstand flu or anything much less severe than this. And it's going to be very, very serious indeed. I mean, I'm now living very near Southampton, which is the home in England of large cruising ships. We can have 9 or 10 big cruising ships in there, the biggest in the world. Well, they're there and they're empty and there's no crew. And people aren't about to say, hey, let's go back cruising, because cruising is a metal box. You get onto it and then somebody coughs at you and you wait to die. I mean, and suddenly jumping on an aeroplane, you're all right and you've got your face mask on, but the air conditioning is pumping everybody else's. You know, a lot of things that we used to do and think were great, they're not going to happen quickly. I absolutely don't believe that. So on my work, we're going to forget the rest of this year. We'll do jolly well if we get through with no worse than twice as bad as 2009. And in some cases, it'll be worse than that. And world trade will be slow to pick up after this.
Well, you know, the thing that really strikes me, they had the NFIB small business survey. And Robin, over 50% of the small businesses said they couldn't last more than 2 months. What I wonder, even if we come back out of this, how many restaurants will survive? As you mentioned, I don't think we're going to be seeing in a stadium watching an NFL game, going to basketball games. And I think people are going to feel funny about going to a restaurant sitting next to somebody or a movie theater.
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree. I mean, the little restaurants near where I'm living that I regularly like to eat at, I talk to the owners of them, and they're all going, gosh, a month we can hang in there. And if you really push us, but it'll hurt, call it 2 months. And if it goes on any more than that, we're out of here. Now, the government, I'm sure the U.S. government's the same, but our government is perfectly willing to make almost free loans available to these people so that they can go through and come back later. But the business owners don't want those loans, because all it means is when we get back to some sort of normal, they're living under a burden of debt, which they've got to service and pay back. And they're not expecting interest rates to stay almost zero forever. Because if you print enough money, you know, it's got to be serviced in the long run. So I think this is, as I say, the quote we need to get into our heads is, this is probably the worst economic situation that I have been through in my life. And it may well be that the only one that was possibly worse was the 29-33 period. And then when you get out the chart and look back at all the previous bear markets I've actually lived through, and 72 to 75 was pretty jolly scary, this is worse. We actually fell quicker than we did in 29 to begin with. And if you remember in 1929, we chartists always look for a special shape on the chart of the bear market. It's an initial fall, followed by a really big rally, followed by the rest of the fall. And back in 1929, the first rally lasted 6 months and was 51%. And then, of course, it spent the next 2 years falling. And there were many, many rallies on the way down. And the people that bought them thinking, I've got the bottom, nearly always went bust because it turned out not to be the bottom. So I think in this more modern world, the bad news is not going to last as long as it did back in the economic depression of the 30s. But in my roadmap, I've always called my work the roadmap. It was always based on economic cycles as written by Schumpeter, and saying if these work, I can project them forward and then show you where the stock market would be. And of course, there are a few more cycles than just the 1 year, 4 year, 10 year and Kondratiev waves. And the story about my cycles was they were in the position of several of them turning down at the same time. I mean, with any system of cycles, there will eventually come a time when most of them go down together. And because cycles can become phase locked, once two or three of the big ones turn down, they almost suck the little ones in together. So you do get a phase knot setback, which is usually in the textbooks called a grand supercycle setback. Now, as we entered the beginning of this year, I was writing in my newsletter that the cycles looked as though they were about to start turning down now. And next year and the year after, we're going to be very negative. And then, this is in January, I said, but as it happens in America, you are in the period running up to presidential election and all sorts of good things happen there. That's typically a bullish thing. And then, of course, over here in England, in January, England didn't know whether it wanted to leave Europe or not. And we had an election, which was a landslide victory to Boris Johnson, making it clear Britain is going to leave Europe. We've got a dominant Tory party, which is going to spend money, and particularly in the northern part of England, because it was the northern voters who stopped being Labour and voted for Boris, saying, get on with this. And then, of course, instead of that happening, we then get a disease right out of the blue. So what's happened is the good news was going to delay the setback in America and Britain, but it was already taking place elsewhere. And then along comes the virus and said, no, we're going to do it now. Which is, of course, nobody could have forecast that. And I don't think even in China they knew quite what was happening, even although they were ahead of us. So we're back on track. And the prediction from my cycles was next year and the year after are going to be very, very tough economic years. And if I had to put a date on when we get to the beginnings of a really proper new bull market, it's 2023. Then I think the next generation, what do we call them? The millennials will be in the driving seat. And there's a lot of new technologies that they will want, and they'll have quite an exciting thing. And they're quite likely coming up from much lower levels than we are now. And all sorts of things that we old baby boomers got used to, this new generation have got whole new things that they can do. And I guess G5 and things like that will all be built in. I mean, one can easily tell a bullish scenario, but we've got to get rid of all this debt. We've got to get houses and certain assets that have been pumped up back down to levels where a normal married couple can afford a property to live in. And I don't know if it's the same all of America, but certainly in here in England, I'm 100 miles out of London where property is cheaper, but my children still can't afford to live like where I live. It's just, you know, values have gone that far, really. So all of that's got to return to something where nice young people with proper jobs can afford an economic activity. And that doesn't look as though that will happen until 2023. So we've got a tough period to get through. So trying to hang it together, I think this disease, the yield curve of the death rate will flatten out. But as soon as governments say start going back to work, and the death rate will pick back up again, so there can be subsequent humps. We will be getting news from pharmaceutical companies encouraged by government money to bring on potential vaccines, and some of them will be jolly helpful, but they won't have passed all the tests so that they're available. You're going to be okay. Probably for at least till the end of this year, and that's super early. It should normally take more than that in time. And meanwhile, elsewhere in the world, this whole disaster is going to rumble on round. So I think it is very serious indeed. So we're trying to survive.
So given this, how does one survive as an investor besides owning gold?
Well, gold, it's not a commodity boom. I mean, most of my charts on commodities, they don't look as bad as oil, but they don't look that great. So it is gold because it's been used as a monetary asset. And it sucks in a little bit of silver because, well, they sort of go together, don't they? Although the gold-silver ratio has been stretched rather sillily. So I think it is gold. Probably you can move away from bullion to some of the best of the mining companies. So I tend to look at things like Newmont, fine managed companies, and they're big and everybody knows the assets are there. I am not a high-tech expert, but I can see that if you were a high-tech expert, many of the stocks would be U.S., and they would be involved with 5G and other things like that, where you could come up. That's not my skill set, though. I'm more an asset class man. I can tell you, coming from very low levels, the highest ranked equity market on my list of world markets, which does just get into the top quintile, is China. Mm. So, of course, it got really, really beaten up first. And I don't believe that the trade battle with America is over yet. But we know that the president can easily do deals. And I think we're all trying to get out of this together. So maybe some sort of agreement with Chinese will happen. But on my work, just following the trends on the chart, if I were to be buying an equity market at the moment, it would have to be China. And there's one other one which we put in because there are some exchange-traded funds. And they're not national. They're not the US one or the British one or the French one. They're called high quality equities. And for the stocks to be high quality, to get on there, they have to tick lots of boxes. So it's an international list of giant super duper blue chip companies. And they've never cut the dividend. They've always made more. They've got money in the bank. They order all of these boxes they tick. And this is actually doing better than an individual country asset. And of course, many of the stocks are US. Some come from all over, though. It's an international list, and it's doing quite well. It's actually in the second category. So it's better than neutral. The US is neutral. This is better than neutral, but not actually in the top group. So if I was tempted to go down my list just a little bit to get some equity in there, it would be that sort of exchange-traded equity that would go in. But perfectly honestly, I don't want to do that, because I think that when the current rally is over, and certainly in our country, I think it has ended. In yours, it can go on a bit longer. We're going to go lower than that first low. We will not only retest the low, I think we're going to take it out easily. Mm. I have no difficulty admitting that the sign that we'd had a plunge and the signs of a low for a jolly good rally, I have no problem with that. I think I heard on your program, Ralph Acampora saying exactly that. And he called it very well, as you would expect him to. And, you know, I see all of those same signals too. But to me, that calls a rally. It doesn't call the next bull market, though. And of course, if it turns down again, Ralph will get the next drop. I'm sure he will. But on my work, it's saying don't be wholly into equities. On the contrary, try and defend your money, and you're going to make a bit in something in gold-related assets. And then go into this bad period with a great big wadge of cash. People say to me, surely what would Warren Buffett do? Well, we know that Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on one of the biggest wadges of cash. This is a jolly good way to go into these difficult times, because they will have the buying power to use when the real, real bargains are there. And that's in the future. We don't know exactly when, but you'll have the money to spend then.
All right. Well, listen, Robin, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work and your newsletter, tell them how they could do so.
Yes, well, I've moved from where I was. The newsletter is very similar to, I've joined something called South Bank Research. which is an English company, and my newsletter is DITA, Dynamic Investment Trend Alert, DITA at South Bank Research. Most Americans will have known of the Agora Press and Mr. Bill Bonner. It's all part of his group, but it's the British end of it, basically. In this particular newsletter, we concentrate on telling which asset class to do. So by taking a group of about 40 exchange-traded funds, you can get exposure to almost any asset class in the world. And that's all you need to do. And each month it tells you do nothing or do this. And we've survived very well because, as they say, our model got us into gold before the break. So we're feeling quite happy with ourselves at the moment.
All right. Well, listen, Robin, you stay safe and hopefully things will clear up and you and I can get some sailing done this summer.
Yeah, indeed.
David Rosenberg, the chief economist and strategist at Rosenberg Research and Associates, joined us on FS Insider this week to talk about the major drawdown in the first quarter GDP number and what he expects for the second quarter, which is really where most of the damage is taking place in the economy currently. Here's a portion of what he had to tell our listeners this week.
We went into this situation not prepared in many different respects. Obviously, from a health standpoint, from an infrastructure on the medical side, clearly unprepared. But also, we didn't have enough cash on hand. And I think that the preservation of cash is going to be something very fundamental that will actually help mitigate the next crisis we have, but is going to hold back this recovery. But I do think that that's what differentiates a recession from a depression, is that the attitudes towards spending and saving and debt accumulation and how we are going to be preserving more cash on the balance sheets, whether you're a household or business, is going through a profound change in the years ahead.
If you'd like to listen to this full interview with David Rosenberg, in addition to our three other interviews airing every week on FS Insider through our website or through a podcast app on your mobile device, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Well, oil prices are rallying at the beginning of the week as a possible cure for coronavirus. But what is this going to mean for the oil markets? The oil markets have fallen to levels we have not seen before, including negative dollar prices for oil. In other words, if you had an oil contract, you had to pay somebody to take your oil off your hands. Where is this heading? Joining us on the program is Dan Steffens from Energy Prospectus. Dan, I wonder if you would explain for our listeners what happened when we saw the price of oil drop about 300% in a single day, where it actually went negative. Let's talk about or begin our discussion there and then go forward as to where oil's heading.
Well, first of all, the producers of the oil, the physical production, we're not really paying people to take their oil. What you see, what traders see in the news every day and why it went negative is that was the front month NYMEX contract, futures contract. And what happened was the guys that were long those contracts and you only had a day or two to close their contracts. And the biggest one was the USO, that's United States Oil Fund. It was long about 106,000 contracts. So it had basically had to figure out how to take 106 million barrels of oil somewhere, and there was nobody to take it. So they really got stuck with, you know, all these contracts that they had to close because they can't physically take the oil. So they had to roll them forward. And typically at the end of a month, when you approach the expiration day of that NYMEX contract, there's refiners that are willing to take those contracts on the cheap and they can physically take the oil, but there wasn't any. So they're just scrambling around like crazy. And it ended up, they had to take it so low, they had to beg people and pay them to take it. And, you know, it's a unique situation. Hopefully it doesn't happen again. And I think the CME group, Chicago Mercantile Exchange group that handles futures contracts, has forced them to close out their positions and roll them forward so that doesn't happen again.
I know that when they were trying to unload those contracts, at one point they had 40% of their money invested in the June contract. So have they reduced that position? Because otherwise you're going to run into the same problem.
Yeah, on late last week or Monday morning or something, they were told that they had to reduce that amount of contracts and roll them forward, and they have. and CME Group gave them 3 days to do it. So supposedly this is the Wednesday is the last day. And I think that has something to do with the jump in the oil price today, because the oil price you're seeing is the front month contract, the June contract.
Dan, let's talk about that contract, because normally the oil markets are in contango, which means that future contracts are worth more than present. If you're in a fund and your contract matures and you have to roll it forward into the next month, you're constantly paying a higher price. You know, the only way you're going to make money on that is backwardation or a sudden spike in oil.
Right. If the front month contract spikes and you're holding a bunch of them, and then you can close out at a higher price. But I wouldn't recommend it right now. Unless I think what happened was, remember, that's when Saudi Arabia and our OPEC Plus and Russia were getting together and going to come up with, you know, this new production quota. And I think they were long that contract because there was this hope that when they agreed to that, there would be a $5 jump in price. Because remember, leading up to that meeting, oil went to like $28, the front month contract. But then after the meeting, when it was only 9.7 million barrels, which isn't enough to offset the 20 million barrel a day drop in demand, the front month contract immediately starts selling down, and they got stuck with all those contracts. Very mismanagement of the fund, if you ask me, but they took the gamble, I guess.
Dan, I want to talk about something else, and that was this oil war that couldn't have come at a worse time between Saudi Arabia and Russia. You know, twice Saudi Arabia has tried to flood the markets, and it's had disastrous results. And, you know, it came at a time that COVID was starting, so demand was falling off a cliff while they were increasing production. So let's talk about that. It seems like they've lost a lot of credibility. That's twice that they've done this. And then I want to move on to Saudi Arabia itself, its reserves, its capabilities, which there are a lot of people that are on the inside doubt that any of those figures are reliable.
Well, what led up to this price war was, you know, the OPEC had a meeting in Vienna near the end of March. And leading up to that meeting, there was all these press releases and, you know, their committees were saying that they had agreement and everything. But then when they got to the actual date of the agreement, Russia backed out. Russia wouldn't agree to the cuts. And they only wanted Russia to cut like another 200,000 or 300,000 barrels a day, which wasn't that much. And Russia could just have agreed to it anyway. They half the time they don't, you know, comply with the agreement. And Saudi Arabia was the one making the most cuts. Well, I think what happened, that made Saudi Arabia, our one man that runs Saudi Arabia, upset. And, you know, I call it childish. I mean, they just then decide to have this price war. And the next, over the weekend after that meeting, he announces he's going to flood the market with oil and try to gain market share. And Russia's going to do the same. And so is, you know, Kuwait and Oman and these others. And the next thing you know, you got oil that was at that time flopping around $40 a barrel, dropping below 30 immediately. I mean, they could have just gone out and burned up $50 billion if they wanted to, but because that's pretty much what they did.
You know, I want to talk about for the longest period of time, the world has always operated under the assumption that Saudi Arabia had these massive oil reserves, which I find amazing that it's been at 266 billion barrels of reserves for, what, 30 years, and they produce a ton of it each year, and it never changes.
Right.
The other figure is that they say they have 2 to 2.5 million barrels of spare capacity. If they wanted to, they could go to 12.5. Dan, the whole time I've been in the business, I have never seen them once produce 12.5 million barrels unless they were selling something out of inventory. So let's talk about this mistaken belief that if we ever get in trouble or in short supply, the Saudis could ramp up and produce 12.5 million barrels. I've never seen it.
Well, we actually have members of our group, Energy Perspectives Group, that worked for Aramco. In fact, one of our members, a guy named Lou Powers, he was the chief reservoir engineer for Aramco just prior to when they, you know, nationalized the company. And he's told me, he says, Dan, you will never see them produce 12 million barrels a day. They're going to hold the production about 10 million barrels a day. Now, when they sell to over 12 million barrels a day, and they can do that because they have oil storage all over the world, because they treat that as, you know, their inventory to meet their customers' demands. And that's what gives Saudi Arabia a lot of the global market share is because they are a reliable source for, you know, these countries and refiners around the world. So they're a reliable source because they have all this inventory. So for a very short period of time, they can sell 12 million barrels a day, but they don't produce 12 million barrels a day. And the one reason is their largest field, Guar, it is on water flood and it's on decline. And a lot of their large fields are on water flood. They're secondary recovery already. And there's still a lot of oil there. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, once reservoirs go on secondary recovery, they're pretty much on terminal decline after, you know, a while. A few years they can hold it up at the initial stage, but you know, you're washing the oil off the rock with water is what you're doing, and eventually it's going to go down.
Let's talk about where this is headed, because you know, one of the sayings in the oil industry, the cure for low prices are low prices. Where's this industry going? I want to talk about American shale here, because it was one of the big disruptors of OPEC in the last couple of years. As we, I think last year we exceeded everybody. We outproduced Saudi Arabia, Russia. Where do we go from here? Because you can't make money at $15 oil.
You know, I get to ask all the time, you know, can this company survive $20 oil? And I will tell you, there's no company and there's no country that can survive $20 oil forever. If we have $20 oil for 5 years, Saudi Arabia will be broke. Every company in OPEC will be broke. I mean, if we stay at 20 through the end of this year, you're going to see 2/3 of the OPEC countries go to total failed states. I mean, a couple of them are already, Libya and Venezuela, but they can't tolerate this for very long, or they're just totally broke. You know, we just got to get out of this. So this can't go on just because it literally can't go on. You're going to see just nothing but declining supply. And assuming we get past this virus madness, I believe we eventually have to live with it one way or the other, we've got to go to work and we've got to rebuild the U.S. and the global economy. And that's going to take a lot of energy and it's going to take a lot of transportation fuels. So we're going to need oil supply. And yes, these low oil prices have caused, I follow like 50 upstream companies and they all have announced cutbacks, if not complete shutdown of their drilling programs.
So when you talk about $20 oil, not even OPEC could survive at these levels that we could go broke. What's going to force the price up? I mean, if we stay in shutdown mode, several governors are extending their quarantine into June, some to the end of May. I mean, if you have planes parked on the runway at airports, if people are in their homes, they're not driving unless they're going to Costco to get food. I mean, what is going to drive this?
Well, the good, you know, Chinese oil demand is pretty much back to normal already. So they've come out of it. And a lot of these European countries know they got to come out of it one way or the other. So it's going to come back. And I think once we get to June, let's say people just, you know, they're tired of being at home. They're going to hit the road. They're going to go on a family trip in their car or something. I mean, we'll start burning something. But regardless, the supply is going to come down to rebalance supply and demand, because underinvestment and pretty much total shutting down of well completions. Even the rigs that are drilling today, half of them are drilling wells that will not be completed. They will drill the well, they'll case the well, and then it'll sit there waiting for higher oil prices before it gets completed. But the unprecedented decline in the active rig count is going to have repercussions through the oil market. And there's right now, I think if oil got back to $50 a barrel tomorrow, you would still see 1.5 to 2 million barrel a day decline in U.S. oil supply.
What's going to happen to these companies, a lot of these shale producers, which really never made money? Mm-hmm. They were able to stay in business because they were able to roll over their debt. But I can't think of any investment bank or any Wall Street firm that wants to lend these guys money. So what happens to these companies? Do they get bought up by the big guys? And then after that, let's talk about what happens to the big guys.
Yeah. Well, the first hurdle that they've got to get over is once they put out their first quarter results, you're going to see companies take big impairment charges, which means they're going to have to write down their oil and gas assets to market. This is a SEC and GAAP accounting requirement. So a lot of them will have their balance sheet ratios fall out of compliance with their debt covenants. Now, a lot of these companies that have a high level of debt or have a credit line, they're also required by those loan agreements to keep a lot of their production hedged. And very few of the companies that I follow don't have a lot of production hedge. So, but they've only got a hedge through the end of the year. So between now and the end of the year, yeah, their realized oil price will be $45 to $50 a barrel through the end of the year, and they can meet their interest payments. They're still positive cash flow at that level, and they can, you know, keep funding their debt. So it's going to be up to the banks that hold those credit facilities, do they want to call those that debt? And debt holders do not win forcing a company into bankruptcy. And if a lot of companies have to go into Chapter 11, there's only so many bankruptcy courts, so it'll back up in the system. They'll be stuck in the Chapter 11 for a long time. And as long as these companies have cash flow, they can still, you know, operate in Chapter 11. And what will happen is the lawyers will make all the money and the debt holders won't. Now, if the oil price does bounce back as expected, and I fully expect that we'll be, you know, heading into next year at a much higher oil price, we have to. And if they can bounce back, then everything should be able to be worked out. But we'll see. I mean, you look at Whiting now. Whiting is in Chapter 11. And their stock price has actually gone up since they went into Chapter 11, because there's a belief that Trump, Team Trump, is going to pass some kind of loan deal or something where they can get loans to replace their bank credit facilities, which makes some sense, because that'll not only help the upstream companies, it'll also help the banks and not force them to go into trouble with bad loans.
Let's take a look at some of the big companies, Chevron, Occidental Petroleum, which made a disastrous acquisition. Exxon have gone into the area. The big question is now, at $20 oil, a lot of these companies have tapped the bond market, from Exxon to many others. Will they be able to maintain their dividend the way they did during the 2014-2016 decline in oil prices?
If oil stays at 20, I would guess no. They're going to get squeezed just like the smaller companies. I mean, their drilling and completion budgets, their operating expenses are not made for $20 oil, so they have a problem. And plus, if you have lower demand for transportation fuels, they're getting squeezed on the refining and marketing end too. So it's their whole food chain is going to be, profits are going to be squeezed. So yeah, you know, I mean, the whole industry needs to have higher prices, and that's why it must go up, because otherwise, I mean, we just kind of let the whole global oil and gas market go to nothing. I mean, we're going to need transportation fuels when we get out of this. So, you know, one thing, Susan and I drove up to Dallas a week or so ago, and I was really amazed by the amount of traffic that was on the highway. I expected to be out there all alone. Now, I could tell you that the car traffic was down, but the truck traffic between Houston and Dallas was still pretty heavy. You know, we're going to need a lot of diesel to start moving, you know, food and other products around once the economy starts picking up again.
In looking at oil going forward, you know, let's say that the economy starts up maybe by the beginning of June. They're already talking about some states already are opening up their economy partially. So let's say by summer, you know, people are driving in their cars, we're going back to work, planes are flying. Dan, I don't know if we're going to see the same level of demand coming back. I mean, I don't know too many people that are going to want to get on an airplane and fly to Italy.
Right. Yeah. How many people are going to jump on a cruise ship right away? It's going to be a mystery how fast these things come back. But yeah, the airline industry, I think, is going to be in trouble for a while. And, you know, maybe they come up with some kind of vaccine or treatment. We'll see. But the level of fear is so high. I know people that tomorrow, if they came out with a cure, I still don't think they'd be comfortable going on a plane or cruise for about a year.
Well, it almost reminds me after the events of 9/11. It almost took almost a year before people felt comfortable to get on airplanes. And that's when, of course, we saw more security at the airports that gave people that sense of, okay, it's safe to fly again. So I guess, you know, either we're going to have a vaccine or they're going to have some kind of drug, the Gilead drug, prompting the market up today. Yeah. And it has some possibilities. But I think it's going to take something like that before you see demand come back. So given that, what would you do as an oil investor? I mean, let's say you own the big companies, you own mid-tiered companies. What would you be doing? Would you be buying? Would you be staying on the sidelines? What would you do?
Well, my focus is now on finding companies that I know will survive 2020 with the goal to thrive next year. You know, if they, I want to own companies now that do have a lot of their production hedged, so they're going to make it through to the end of the year with the belief that the oil price is going to bounce back. And I truly believe it will. And I also believe the seeds have been planted for an oil shortage. I mean, if we get anywhere close to back to normal, and it's not just us, it's the rest of the world. You know, half the people in the world live in Asia. And Asia, I don't think today is much more different than what they were in 6 months ago. So it appears their economies are going to bounce back much faster. And if that happens, and let's say we go from 100 million barrels a day of demand to, you know, 96 or 97 million barrels a day of demand, these low oil prices that we have today are going to destroy at least 5 or 6 million barrels a day of supply. We're now, even EIA is projecting that we're going to be 1 million to 1.5 million, 2 million barrels a day short of supply by the end of this year, by the end of the fourth quarter. And yes, we'll have a lot of in inventory to cushion that. We'll have to, you know, draw down that inventory first. But if demand stays above supply for very long, the only cure for that is higher fuel prices. So you start rationing by price the fuel. Now, that scares me a bit because, you know, it could just be that here the global economy is starting to get its feet under it again. And then you have higher fuel prices, and that could be like an additional tax on the economy. So anyway, we live in an unprecedented world, so it's going to be an interesting year, that's for sure.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, give out your website, please.
Yeah, we're energyperspectives.com. So you can just go, you can Google just Energy Perspectives Group and you can find us, or you can send me an email. My email is dmstefens@comcast.net. And if you send me an email, I will send you a promo code and some information about our group. And if you're interested in getting some straight talk on individual companies, we're a good place to go. So send me an email.
All right. Well, listen, Dan, stay safe and come back and talk again.
All right. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of Smart Macro, where we speak, as always, with our Chief Investment Officer of Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. Chris, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, let's talk about what we've seen since we last spoke with you 2 weeks ago. The market has generally still been positive. You know, we saw some volatility this week, but give us an update on where things are at in your mind when we think about perhaps even the divergence that as many people are talking about, as Dave Rosenberg spoke on FS Insider this week, between the market and the economy.
Well, I think the divergence makes a lot of sense because if you look at where things have come from, we had an unprecedented bear market decline where we fell 20% in just 16 trading days. That was the fastest 20% decline that we have ever seen, even going back to the Great Depression. And equally, if you look at the rally off the lows, it has been equally as impressive as the decline was. But, you know, the rally off the lows makes sense in light of how much stimulus has been thrown at this. If you look at the legislative actions, we've got about $3.6 trillion allocated from the federal government. And then if you look at the Federal Reserve is potentially adding $9.2 trillion between asset purchases, liquidity measures, and emergency lending programs and facilities. So we're talking literally over $12 to $13 trillion that's going to be applied over time. And there's, when you look at that amount of stimulus, you would expect some kind of a recovery in financial assets, not necessarily in the economy. The economy is going to take a while to recover. But in terms of financial markets, you know, that's a lot of discounting and a lot of stimulus being applied to the markets.
And as we all know, the Federal Reserve does not want to see a massive crash in the markets. They don't want to see asset values fall too much, because if that happens, we see the negative wealth effect, right? There's the positive wealth effect when asset values are going up, and just the reverse when asset prices are crashing. So they're doing everything they can to keep those bid up, because they don't want to see a massive crash to consumers and for people to pull back. And obviously, they don't want to see too many people start saving, which was something that Rosenberg had brought up, that he thinks the coronavirus is going to shift people to now save more money, which of course is going to lower the amount of consumption and production economic activity we see, which will put us in a better place for the long run, but it may subdue economic activity, at least in this current crisis. What are your thoughts on that?
I would agree. You know, I think the you know, there's still going to be the unknown. Are we going to have another round of this? Are we going to, you know, possibly shut down again in the fall? We don't know how long it will take till we get a vaccine. So there are some unknowns. So I think it would make sense for corporations and households to hold back some of the income benefits they're getting from the government to weather that storm. I mean, everyone wants to be prudent with planning for the future. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do see an increase in the savings rate. But that amount of increased savings, you know, that does provide better balance sheets going forward, as some of that money could be spent at a later time.
Chris, I think you said earlier that you don't think it's likely we're going to retest the lows. And part of that was because of the $12 to $13 trillion of stimulus. Did I get that number right? $12 to $13
trillion? That's correct. If you look at all the facilities that the Federal Reserve has enacted, they're looking at over $9.2 trillion. And the legislative actions are totaling $3.6 trillion. Now, that's been allotted, but not all of that has been dispersed, which will take time. But that's how much we have potentially to go into the economy and financial markets. And what that's going to do in current estimates is we're going to see the budget deficit as a share of GDP coming in at 18.7%. And next year, the forecast is for a 9.7% budget deficit. And to put that in context, the worst point of the last recession, we saw the budget deficit reach 10.1% of GDP in 2009. We're virtually nearly doubling that this year, and we're going to be just under that next year. So this is really pushing the amount of debt that the federal government is issuing to the point where the amount of debt will equal the size of the economy this year. And we haven't had a debt-to-GDP ratio of over 100% since World War II. So this is a lot of debt and a lot of stimulus being thrown in response to this crisis. And for that reason, I do think it's unlikely that we're going to retest the lows or even go below them, given how much stimulus is being applied.
When I go to the usdebtclock.org, this shows all of the debts, revenues, every single breakdown that you could imagine when it comes to the U.S. government. And they show total debt to GDP ratio now at 131%. The U.S. federal debt to GDP ratio is at 116%. So we're now well above 100% at this point. And then it's projected that that's now going to get even worse or even higher.
That's correct. And one of the things that is important to understand is whenever you increase the money supply, and that can be done through the Federal Reserve buying the debt of the government as well as issuing other reserve credit, is you can generally get inflation. You can get inflation in the form of asset inflation, or you can get the goods and service inflation that most people recognize. And if you look at the last 10 years, last decade, if you look at the massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, and this is something I did recently, is I compared the S&P 500, nominal GDP, the Fed's balance sheet, as well as the CPI index. And I normalized them all the way to 100 beginning in the first quarter of 2009. So when we look at, you know, how this has impacted the markets and economy, there's clearly a much higher growth in the S&P related to the Fed's balance sheet, while we've seen only a marginal increase in terms of GDP or the CPI index. For example, for every dollar increase in the Fed's balance sheet, we've seen the S&P increase by $1.12. And for the economy, we've seen the economy increase only 46 cents and the CPI index increase only 37 cents. So the economy and the CPI index are not even increasing one for one in terms of the Fed's balance sheet since 2009, while we're seeing clearly a lot more of that going into the S&P 500 and stocks. So with all this stimulus that's being applied, I think we're going to continue to see asset inflation. And that's why I don't think that we're going to retest the lows or breach them for that matter.
Along those lines, let's talk about the financial markets study you did. I believe you looked at every bear market since World War II. What were some of the conclusions that came out of that?
What we wanted to look at was what happens once the market has retraced at least half of its prior decline after falling by at least 20%, which defines a typical bear market. And what we found was pretty fascinating. There was over 10 examples of bear markets. And of all of those, only one case did we see the market retrace half of its prior decline and eventually hit new lows. And that was in the prolonged 1946 to 1949 bear market. The market initially, the S&P 500 initially retraced half of its prior decline in the middle of 1948, but it subsequently rolled over and took another year before it hit its ultimate low in June of 1949. But that new low was only 1.6% lower than where the market bottomed when it staged its initial rally. But all the other examples that we have is once the market retraces half of its decline, that's it. It's not a bear market rally. We don't hit new lows. It's beginning of a new bull market. And what we did is we looked at all of those examples. And what we wanted to see was once you hit that 50% recovery mark, what is your worst drawdown over the next 3 months and 6 months? While the bottom may be in, can you still have a significant correction after you hit that 50% retracement mark? And looking at all the bear markets since World War II, the average drawdown was about just under 6%. That was the worst over the next 3 months. Over the next 6 months, your worst decline that you saw from that 50% retracement was about an 8% decline. However, that's the max drawdown. That's not where you ended. So when we looked at 3 month forward returns and 6 month forward returns from that 50% retracement date, what were the average returns? And within 3 months, you're up another 6%. And within 6 months, you're up about 6.5%. So on average, once you hit that 50% retracement mark, 3 months and 6 months out, you typically are positive. And one of the things that we're going to put in an article on the web is we'll show this in terms of what the best case and worst case scenario is and what the average path for the S&P may be. And just looking at the worst case scenario, you know, the worst decline that we could see by this summer, if we followed the historical precedent of other bear markets recoveries, could see the S&P fall just under 2,600. So a mild decline, but nothing like retracing the entire bull market advance that we've had, which would be quite severe.
What about the fear that this current mini depression or recession could develop into a depression? This is something now that, I mean, the D word is getting bounced around quite a bit. It sounds like from your analysis, you don't expect that from a market standpoint, given the, again, $12 to $13 trillion of stimulus that have been brought to bear to the market so far. But what about on the economic side?
You know, I don't think that we're going to get into a depression for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that, you know, the excesses of the prior expansion were centered in the corporate channel. If you look at corporate debt to GDP, that absolutely surged. Well, we saw only a mild increase in household debt to GDP, which means that the consumer came into this recession in better shape than they did heading into the great financial crisis of 2007-2009. Secondly, the stimulus that we've seen is directed right at the consumer this time. And what it's doing is it's providing a bridge to the other side. So this may be one reason why, if you look at confidence numbers that we've been starting to get, consumer confidence and individual investor sentiment don't look as dire as what we're seeing in corporate institutional surveys. And when you look at some of the data that Goldman Sachs has compiled, what they essentially looked at is what the loss of income is relative to the potential stimulus that various sectors of the economy are going to receive. And based on what they've income, based on their numbers, the actual decline in income is not going to be that severe. They're forecasting roughly a 3% decline in worker income in 2020 relative to the pre-crisis level. And then they're looking at a 5% decline in corporate income this year relative to the pre-crisis level. And when they combine the forecast for labor income, corporate dividends, proprietors' income, interest, rental income, tax cuts, and government payments to individuals, they're projecting that disposable personal income will actually increase this year by 0.5% relative to pre-crisis levels. So that's pretty fascinating when you think about the hit to incomes. You know, incomes will be hit, but not so severely because of how much stimulus has been thrown at this. But as you know, others are pointing out, you know, the stimulus and replacement of income doesn't necessarily translate into economic growth. For example, as David Rosenberg stated this week on Insider, we're likely to see corporations and individuals hold back some of that income in terms of increased savings, which means that it's not going to get into the economy and stimulate economic growth. But in terms of actual income loss, it should be quite muted based on all the stimulus that's being directed at consumers and corporations.
What are some of the other reasons why you don't think that we will either test the lows or go below the lows that we saw in March?
Part of the reason I feel that is it's important to look at positioning in terms of how people are allocated in the markets, and then also in terms of sentiment. When sentiment is incredibly bullish, typically everyone's all in. And when everyone is bearish, that's when you tend to see people who have put money on the sidelines and essentially are prepared for the worst, which is actually when you want to invest. You want to do the opposite of everyone at extremes. And one thing that's been pretty interesting since 2018, and we saw this begin once we hit a mini bear market in the fourth quarter of 2018, but we also saw this continue throughout 2019, despite the market rallying and hitting new all-time highs last year. And we saw even further this year, and that's the movement into money markets. Money market assets in the US stood at roughly $3 trillion by the end of 2018. And beginning in the summer of last year, they grew to $3.1 trillion. And when we ended the year, they were at $3.6 trillion. So over $500 billion went into money markets last year, despite the stock market rallying and as well seeing the bond market rally. And what we saw last month was unprecedented. We went from $3.6 trillion in money market funds to the current rate of $4.7 trillion. So there is a massive, massive amount of money on the sidelines in cash as investors remain fearful, even with the market rallying and replacing half of the decline that we've seen. There's still a tremendous amount of money in money markets and in the bond market and out of equities.
So basically, those who have sold have mostly already sold.
That's correct. And we can see that through other surveys. There's the American Association of Individual Investors, and essentially it's looking at the sentiment by the average individual investor. And one of the things they ask is, what's your average allocation to stocks, bonds, and cash? And just going back to even a few months ago, the average stock allocation by the individual investor was somewhere between 60 and 70%. The all-time high was seen leading up to the January 2018 high of around 72% during this bull market. That was the highest point that we had seen. Currently, they're around 50-55% or so allocated to equities. That is the lowest allocation to equities since 2012. So, you know, clearly they have not gone back into the stock market. The amount of money they took out is sitting on the sidelines, and that explains the massive movement in money market funds. But it's not just individual investor. When we look at the North American Association of Individual or Investment Managers, so this is looking at institutional money managers like ourselves that are, you know, registered investment advisors, and it's asking what their average allocation is to stocks. And just before this decline, they were around 100% allocated to equities in terms of what their normal allocation or maximum allocation is. And currently, they're only at 45%. And that's below the average we've seen since 2006, which is roughly 62%. So they're clearly off their highs. They have improved. They have put some money to work. The low that we saw was roughly 10% allocated to equities. Now they're at 45, but they're still off their highs, and they're not even at average equity allocation levels. So if you look at the individual investor, they're not in this market. The average institutional investor is only starting to get back in the market. And when you look at sentiment, sentiment is still quite bearish. From the American Association of Individual Investors, if you look at the sentiment readings that they have, the percent that are bearish, we're at 50%. Half of all those surveyed are still bearish. And just before this decline, only around 20% were bearish. So even with this market rally that we've seen, they're still net 50% bearish. And that's about where we were at the lows in the bear market of 2018. And that's also where we were at the worst point of that 2015-16 decline. So if you go back 10 years, we're clearly a lot closer to the higher levels of bearish readings, and the which is bullish, in my opinion, for the market than the low level of bearish sentiment.
Well, Chris, if I were to summarize the conversations that we've been having over the course of this year so far, you know, we started out with the leading economic indicators improving, obviously the market gains being pretty strong. Then we started to see them tip over. The market started to crack in February. And as things were progressively getting worse and worse, you were talking about moving to more defensive position in with Financial Sense Wealth Management clients' portfolios and raising cash during the decline. And then as we got to the bottoms in mid to late March, that's when you were saying that you were steadily going in, buying, taking advantage of some major dislocations that were taking place where especially fund managers, bond managers, I mean, they had to sell their inventory, and that we were going in, taking advantage of those discounts, those deals, and buying. Since then, you were a little bit skeptical about the strength of the rally and how far it would go given the credit markets, but again, still taking advantage when those opportunities were given during the major part of the sell-off in March. Is that a fair assessment of what's taken place over the past few months or so? And what do you see moving forward?
That is, you know, we were taking, you know, we were going into the February peak at, you know, full allocation to equities. And once it became apparent that this was going to spill over to the U.S. and this would impact the economy, we, you know, aggressively began to raise cash, which really helped us on the downside. But once we saw the market down over 30%, which it's, you know, few and far between where the market falls more than 30%, that's a rare event. And because of that, we started to put money to work both in equities and particularly in fixed income. Looking at the corporate bond market, the dislocation was unbelievable, where at one point we were buying A-plus quality corporate bonds that were only 2 years to maturity, and we were getting north of 5%. Those have clearly evaporated. I wouldn't even touch something like that now, where because the yields have compressed so much with the Fed coming in. But so those, you know, the fixed income opportunities are gone. But if you look at the equity side, there's still some value out there. Small caps, mid caps haven't appreciated as much as the general market has. Individual stocks haven't appreciated as much as the market has. And so from our opinion, if you look at all the stimulus, I think we're going to get more asset inflation. And what I believe we're going to see is I think Wall Street will do a lot better than Main Street, meaning I think financial markets will hold up relatively well compared to the economy.
What are your thoughts on the general income environment? What does an investor do in this environment if they are looking for some type of decent yield?
You know, it was nice for that period when the Fed was raising interest rates and we can get better than 0% for our clients for short-term rates. And at one point we were getting, you know, 1.5% to 2% on T-bills. You know, those are treasury securities that mature in less than a year. And we're back to zero again. You know, it's a very difficult environment, particularly for savers and those who live on fixed income in retirement. And, you know, I think with the unemployment rate is likely to go way over 10%. I think Goldman's estimating around 15% is what they think the peak will be. And it's going to take a while to get people back to work because it's going to take a while to get the economy going back to a pre-crisis level. And for that reason, I think the Fed is going to stay at zero for the foreseeable future, well into, I think, 2021 and possibly beyond. So that means, unfortunately, CD rates are going to plunge and our checking and savings deposit rates are going to plunge. So virtually everything that's short term is going to basically go back to zero. And the other side of the coin, I do think we're going to see a general rise in interest rates on the long end, on long-term treasuries, so 10 years and out further. And the reason why I say that is when I looked at the Fed's balance sheet and overlaid that with the 10-year treasury yield, so I'm looking at QE1, QE2, QE3, every time the Fed was expanding its balance sheet, we saw a general increase in interest rates. Because when the Fed expands its balance sheet, we typically see a slight pickup in inflation. We also see a pickup in economic growth. And when the Fed ended QE, we tended to see the economy slip back into a muddle mode where we had virtually slow or no growth and interest rates would plummet. And when the Fed was actually decreasing its balance sheet with quantitative tightening in 2018 and 19, we saw interest rates fall pretty consistently going into the middle part of last year. However, you know, in the fourth quarter of last year, the Fed began to expand its balance sheet and interest rates were rising going into this year. But once the impact of the coronavirus outbreak began to take hold globally, interest rates plunged and then they fell to record levels. The 30-year treasury got down to as low as 1%. And the one-year treasury got below 0.5%. So one of the things I think we're going to see with this massive amount of money printing by the Fed is a general rise in interest rates. So while a lot of investors had phenomenal returns on their long-term treasury portfolios, I think those gains are going to start to evaporate as interest rates move higher. That's my belief. And what we've done at our firm is we have moved out of our treasuries because I don't see any value there, and we rotate into corporate bonds. But if you have cash that you have at the bank and you did sell out of equities or out of other bonds, you don't know what to do with that cash, there are other options. You know, there's still some corporate bonds out there that have a decent yield to them. And one of the things we also do is we wait for declines. You know, we wait for a possible, you know, small downgrade where we can pick up something that becomes discounted, or we look for other areas where an ETF might dump a bunch of bonds to raise some cash. So, you know, we try to be opportunistic whenever we can, and we look for bargains, and we do a lot of negotiating with the bond dealers that we work with to always try and improve the price for a client. So if anyone's stuck in that position where they're back to zero and they don't know what to do, you know, feel free to give us a call and we can certainly help them.
Well, Chris, if any of our listeners want to find out more about that or even just discuss some of the things that we brought up into today's show regarding your outlook, and of course, including Financial Sense Wealth Management Services, what would be the best way to get a hold of you?
They can reach me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Chris, always a pleasure to have you on the show again for this week's edition of Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks.
Thanks for having me on.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.